The man behind me needs very little explanation, but I'd like to introduce you all to Peter Singer. He is the grandfather, many say the grandfather of the effective altruism movement as well as the animal rights movement, the author of The Life You Can Save and founder of the Life You Can Save organization, the DeKalb Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, and author of Famine, Affluence, and Morality, one of the papers that got me and many other people in the audience in this room today. We have the panelists that we can bring onto the stage now. If you would like to be involved with the panel discussion for a couple of minutes, I know you have to leave at 6, so we can get the panelists on stage now, and then if people have questions in the audience, I can pass around a microphone and get one or two questions in before you leave. Does that sound all right?
Yeah, that's good. That's what I was expecting.
All right, great. Cool, that sounds great. So can you raise your hand if you have a question in the audience? And we'll get a microphone from the back around to you so you can ask your question. Okay, no questions starting off. All right, cool. Yeah, since he's a bit time constrained, I think we'll start with questions with him and then pull the panel up. Great, go ahead.
Hey, thank you for your time. I think the question in I think the question in everybody's mind here is, how do you end world poverty?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I think the first thing I want to say about that is that we are in the process of doing that. Some people get up ask that question as if to say, somehow we're not getting there and we need some very radical change. Roxanne mentioned the book that I wrote, The Life You Can Save, which was published in 2009, probably went to press, I guess, at the end of 2008. In that book, I said that there were about 10 million children dying every year from avoidable poverty-related causes. That was the UNICEF figures. That was something like 9.8 million, in fact. If we look at the latest UNICEF figures today, we're below 6 million. We're down to 5.9 million. So we're saving 4 million lives a year through reductions in poverty and providing things like safe drinking water, reducing diarrhea, providing bed nets against malaria, immunization against measles, a whole range of causes and food. So that's one indication of progress. We can also look at the World Bank's indications of the number of people living in extreme poverty. The World Bank said late last year that it would fall below 10% of the world's population, so to around 750 million people. Again, that's a huge reduction, and it's a reduction despite the fact that the world's population is increasing. So the proportion of people in extreme poverty is falling as well. So I think, we want to keep doing these things. Obviously, economic growth in a number of countries, China in particular, but India as well, has made a significant difference too. It's not only the aid programs. But I think all of this is actually working. And I think while certainly we should be working as active citizens to try to get a better trade deal for developing countries in various ways, to reduce agricultural subsidies, all of those things will help. And anything we can do to improve transparency in international trade, to improve standards of international governments domestically as well, all of those things are going to help. But I don't think that we should be thinking about some dramatic change in the economic system. I think that we're getting there as we are, and the idea of overthrowing global capitalism is, I think, a pipe dream for the foreseeable future. I just can't see that happening. So I think we shouldn't be distracted by that kind of way of thinking. I think we should be looking at the progress we're making and being empirically minded about how we can continue to make that progress, and if possible, make it even faster.
Yeah,
Hi, Professor. It's a great honor to kind of ask you a question. So one of my friends actually recommended me a book yesterday, which I haven't had the opportunity to read, but I'm Wikipediaing it right now. So it's one of your earlier books. It was written in 1999, A Darwinian Left. And you talk about, at least the summary talks about, that although humans are selfish, we are able to make short-term sacrifices for the long-term goal. And being at EA, I think that's kind of the point of our mission. And you said that society takes requires certain conditions for that to happen. What are those conditions, kind of 10 years down the line? What do you think those conditions that society can facilitate further cooperation? Thank you.
Right. Thanks for mentioning A Darwinian Left. For those who don't know it, what I was trying to do was persuade people on the left that we need to accept, obviously, the truth of the Darwinian theory of evolution, and we need to take that on board in terms of thinking how we can get to the kinds of goals of helping people in need that I certainly share with the left. And so we need to. And it's a very short book, by the way. If anyone else wants to have a look at it, it won't take you more than a couple of hours to get through it. So what I think we need to do is to encourage those forms of cooperative and altruistic actions by, fostering the kind of society that encourages that rewards people for cooperating, but also doesn't presume that human nature is going to be radically different in the near future. So given that we have a Darwinian inheritance, it's clear that we are going to be thinking a lot. You're going to have strong desires about our own interests and those of people who are close to us, our immediate family and close friends that we're in cooperative relationships with. We can't expect people to abandon that. But we do have the capacity to reason and to think about the way we live our lives. And if we can show people that it's actually rewarding to do good things for others, then that's more likely to happen. And one of the things that I think is important in the effective altruism movement is not to think of working to make the world a better place as a sacrifice. It may be in material terms. It may be that there are, if you give money to effective organizations, you're going to be driving a Toyota rather than a BMW or Mercedes. But, is that really a big deal compared to the feeling of fulfillment that you're actually doing something to help people in great need, that you're part of this wonderful tradition of people who are making the world a better place and you're working together with others to achieve that? And, I think a lot of people understand that. Charlie Bressler, who is actually the unpaid executive director of the Life You Can Save, of the organization, used to have a career in retailing, became the president of a large men's clothing chain. He says, when he talks about the life you can save, the life that I saved is my own, because he feels that he's given his life much more meaning through working for the life you can save than he ever did through making more money in the retail industry. And I think that a lot of people can understand this, and if we spread that idea around, I think we'll get more people, as I say, not being saints, not being 100% altruistic in everything they do, but making the world a better place, becoming an important part of their lives.
So my name is Rain. I took one of your courses on Coursera, and I run a nonprofit for abused and neglected children in New York State, and you made me want to completely leave my career and move to a foreign country that I've never heard of and can't find on a map in order to save people. But I guess the big question is, after I took the course, it made me reevaluate what I was doing in the altruism movement. And I know that, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, scientists doing this and this, or what is the best career goal in order to be altruistic. And so as someone who's in a nonprofit that really shouldn't quit her job right after, like, 10 minutes from now, what would you recommend? Would you recommend that, you know, people stay on the same path of what they're doing, or would you recommend that they go to places like GiveWell or things like that if they're already established in their careers?
Well, it's very, you know, good question and a difficult one. I don't know enough about you and enough about the work that you do, but I assume that you've got a reasonable amount of experience that you've built up in this area of helping abused kids in New York somewhere, that you're making a significant difference there, and that if you were to leave your position, that it would be, you would be hard to replace, and it would be difficult to, at least in the short term, for the organization to do work that's as good as it's doing. So that's a, that would be a powerful reason for staying where you are. Now that you're aware of the fact that there are people in, you know, huge need elsewhere in the world, you might think about whether there is something that you can also do to contribute there. Maybe your expertise in working with abused kids in the U.S. Is to some extent translatable to other countries. Maybe you can encourage people who support your organization to think that there are also abused kids in other countries who need help. Maybe you can establish some relationship with organizations working in developing countries or in a developing country where there are kids who need help. And that could, you know, I can imagine that that could even be a plus for your organization, that it has this connection, that, that it's encouraging people to help kids in need in the U.S., in New York, but also in wherever else it might be, some developing country where the needs are very great and the resources are much scarcer than they probably are for you. So I'd encourage you to think about those possibilities, about a sort of we know how the Twin Cities movement works, so maybe some sort of twin organizational twinning idea might work for you and your organization. Just a suggestion.
Do you have time for one more question?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I can take one more.
Okay, great. Yeah, we'll take this hand in the front.
So far, we see that the international development industry is actually very costly, very wasteful. And then we see that the countries like China, India, even African states are economically coming out because they're turning capitalism. Are we seeing that the main impact of improvement in human quality of life is caused by investment and job creation, and that the social development sectors, activists and NGOs are claiming the results of the capitalists and saying that, yeah, all together we make life better, but actually the social development sector is actually not doing very much?
I don't think that that is quite accurate. I certainly agree that investment and economic growth and development is making an important difference. But there are some studies, I'm thinking here of the work of Branko Milanovic, a book called Worlds Apart, and a number of studies of global inequality have suggested that economic growth certainly helps people in the lower half of communities in developing countries. But it appears not to have really had a big impact on people in the lowest 10% of the world's population in economic terms. So if we're thinking about, as I said, the World Bank claims that extreme poverty has now fallen to around 10% of the world's population. So if we're focusing on that 750 million people, roughly, there is some evidence that they're not really able to participate in the economic growth to a significant extent. And that it is the kinds of things that I talked about in my opening remarks. It's the provision of sanitation, safe drinking water, and other things that aid organizations do, providing education, in some cases providing better farming techniques or better seeds. But those things have made a significant difference in terms of the well-being of that bottom 10% of the population. So it's difficult, you know, exactly to quantify this, to say how we measure the varying impacts. But we do have good evidence from the small number of highly effective and transparent organizations about the impact of what they're doing, about the impact of distributing bed nets on reducing child mortality from malaria, for example. So, you know, it's clear that these things are making a difference. And although, as you said, you know, taken as a whole, the international aid development efforts have been relatively costly, not hugely costly, I would say, but relatively costly. I think if we focus on the most effective organizations, they're not that costly at all in terms of what they're achieving. Okay, I'm going to have to leave you at this point. I'm sorry about the time constraints, but I'm in a different place and already had some commitments when I was asked to take part in this. So it's been good to get a chance to speak to you. Thanks very much for your questions, and I hope you have a exciting panel discussion following me. Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I think his last answer is a really great lead-in to the following panel on the end of poverty. We have a very accomplished set of people here to answer all of the questions that you wanted to send to him. Now you get to ask a set of four or five people on the stage. So the moderator for this panel is Rajesh Mirchandani. He is the Senior Director of Community and Policy Outreach at the Center for Global Development. I think I got that right. And has spent, prior to that, the last 20 years at BBC being an international news reporter on some of the most interesting and important events in the past 20 years, especially covering things like the Haitian earthquake. And now he's here today to help us discuss further ways in which we might end poverty. So please, welcome to the stage.
Hello, everyone. Thanks very much for joining us. It was great to see Peter Singer give us some really interesting words of wisdom. So they've given us 40 minutes to figure out the end of poverty. We may not come to a conclusion. I'm just warning you. But let me invite my panelists up straight away, and we can launch right into it. So Peter Singer was telling us there about 700 million people still living in poverty, which is a lot of work left to do. The Sustainable Development Goals, which were adopted almost a year ago, provide a blueprint for creating a world where all people can live with opportunity and free of the problems that limit their potential: hunger, bad health, lack of education, polluted air, discrimination, etc., etc. There's 17 goals, 169 targets, and several hundred metrics for measuring progress. So it shows that there's going to need to be a lot of different approaches. At the Center for Global Development, where I work now, our approach is to look at policy. We aim to change the policies of rich countries and powerful institutions like the World Bank towards developing countries, not to make sacrifices for people like us, but to find the win-win. How can we increase global prosperity for all? Our panel represents small, on-the-ground NGOs right up to the behemoth of USAID. So they represent the entire range of approaches, and the scale of the SDGs tells us that we're going to need a huge range of approaches if we want to try and end poverty by 2030 or by whenever. So let me introduce our panelists. Panelists, what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce you, and then I'm going to give you each 2 minutes to say a little bit about what your organization does, what you do there, and why you think that's a good approach to ending poverty. So let me start right on my right here with Anne Healy, who is the lead for Discover and Test, which is part of Development Innovation Ventures, which is at USAID. I hope I got those titles right, Anne. Jeff Brown is the Chief Executive Officer of Evidence Action, and Jeff has a huge kind of like enormous kind of resume of accomplishments in development. He's worked at the World Bank, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, the Inter-American Development Bank. He was the interim CEO at the Global Innovation Fund when you spoke at the conference last year, I think. So if anyone knows the answer to the question about ending poverty, it should be you, Jeff. Next to Jeff, Timothy Tallene Lawton, a senior research analyst at GiveWell. We've heard a lot about GiveWell in the last couple of days, who review and recommend charities for people to make contributions to. And the Against Malaria Foundation is currently their top pick. And at the end of the line, Sveta Janumpali is the founder and CEO of New Incentives, which is an NGO that she founded that does cash transfers, but cash transfers that are conditional on good behavior. So families in need must meet certain standards, must achieve certain goals before funding is provided to them. And they're operating in five countries so far, I think. One country. Okay. Maybe by the end of this session, it'll have gone up to five, I hope. So, Anne, I'm going to start with you.
Sure.
The clock is ticking. 2 minutes.
Thanks, Rajesh, and thanks, everyone, for being here. So as you mentioned, I work at USAID, the behemoth in the room, where I run Development Innovation Ventures, otherwise known as DIV, which is about as close to the agency's form of a VC fund as it gets. We're an open innovation competition that uses grant funding to rigorously test and scale innovations and development. So what does this look like in practice? First, we're an open competition, which means we will take ideas from anyone, anywhere, any sector, any geography, any time. And so this means we really do fund a wide range of organizations and a wide range of ideas, ranging from research organizations like IPA and JPAL to developing country NGOs like Pratham in India, to for-profit social enterprises in the U.S. working on development issues or those based in developing countries. Second, we use a tiered evidence-based funding model, which invests comparatively small amounts of funding in relatively unproven concepts and continues to support and scale only those that demonstrate that they have an evidence base underlying them. So we're willing to take risks on ideas. We expect a number of ideas to fail because what we're optimizing for ultimately is for an overall portfolio social rate of return that is strong. Third, we center our funding decisions on three core criteria, the first of which is rigorous evidence of impact, the second is cost effectiveness, and the third is potential to scale. So we have a staff and a network of external experts who help us kick the tires on the applications we receive. We're generalists. We're not sector specialists. The blessing and a curse of being an open innovation competition. And we continue to support organizations across all these dimensions as we support them if they come into our portfolio. And finally, we take an expansive view of what innovation means. This isn't just sort of tech-based products, but this is also innovations in service delivery mechanisms, innovations in business processes, new behavioral nudges. So even very low-tech innovations are innovations in our mind if they're helping crack the nut on really hard and big development problems. So on your question about, you know, what do I think is kind of the most effective way to take a stab at eliminating global poverty, I think, you know, to Peter Singer's earlier point, I'll deflect a little bit. I think we need to, you know, recognize that we have and are making a lot of progress, but we need to be rigorous and disciplined about how we think about the types of things we support. So we at DIV are fairly agnostic about sort of sector and issue. It's got to be a big issue, and you have to bring to bear evidence and a theory of change that's informed by evidence for us to kind of be interested in helping you.
Great. And thank you very much. Jeff, same for you. 2 minutes, please. Just explain what you do at your organization, why that's the right approach.
Okay.
Or maybe it isn't.
Good afternoon, everybody. When I first saw the title of this panel, I was ecstatic and a little creeped out about big data because I happen to know the answer, assuming there's a typo in the title of this panel. I, little known fact, grew up on Poverty Lane in New Hampshire, Lebanon, New Hampshire. And I can tell you that the answer to this question is... On one end, it ends in Stores Hill. That's the name of the road. And on the other end, Poverty Lane, actually, this is perhaps prophetic, ends and connects into the Miracle Mile. So,
oh, wow.
Anyway.
If that isn't a metaphor for the SDGs, what is
it? Yeah, exactly. And so you can't make this stuff up in New Hampshire, at least. I would say that, so I'm the CEO of Evidence Action, and we are a nonprofit that is attempting to kind of bridge the gap between a lot of R&D that's being done by other parties with how do you transition these things to scale. And so we're looking for things that have a lot of evidence behind them, often randomized controlled trials, and we're trying to wrap around business models, which could look very different in different ways, in order to try to figure out how to scale them. Care about evidence, scaling, and the way to kind of link those things together is actually to really, like the private sector, push cost way down. And so we have a couple flagships. You've heard about them in other panels. We have been given some love by GiveWell in the past and other places. And what we look to do, what does this look like? One of our programs is school-based deworming. We help governments, five of them around the world, get deworming pills to kids to the tune of, you know, not quite 200 million kids a year. And then on the side of clean water, we're working with chlorine dispensers in order to, in East Africa, for about $1.25 to $1.25 per person per year, get clean water at point of use, backed by a lot of evidence, and to the scale that's absolutely gigantic of, you know, 4.5 million people. We have a new program, which maybe we can get into a little bit later, that we're just starting to build out, which is about seasonal migration, trying to help people who are rural farmers who have a downtime because of the agricultural cycle, get temporary jobs in the cities very cheaply by actually subsidizing a bus ticket, de-risking things for them, and then we have a lot of evidence suggesting that this actually leads to one square meal a day more for their rural families, all the members of their families. Because of, you know, breaking down some of the barriers that face internal migrants in certain countries. So with that, I'll stop.
Okay, Jeff, thanks very much. Tim.
Great, thanks so much. So really my primary expertise is being an overeager effective altruist. I've spent some years early on in my career trying to change state and national level policy in favor of the public interest. Spent a little over a year doing an earning to give type strategy, and then I've been at GiveWell since 2013. I'm actually not speaking on behalf of my employer during this talk, so views are just my own. But the thing that does excite me about the opportunity that GiveWell has is because so much money is given on an annual basis across especially the developed world, most of our donors are from the US, Australia, and the UK. If we can improve if we can target that donated money to the more cost-effective opportunities and actually change the incentives ultimately for those giving opportunities to actually be able to show the evidence that they're actually having a positive impact, then that has the potential to be able to help transform the impact that's made through the aid in the long term. So that's why I'm excited about GiveWell.
Okay. And Sveta.
Hi, everyone. I'm the CEO of New Incentives. We implement conditional cash transfer programs. So specifically, we give money to pregnant women in Nigeria when they deliver their baby in a health clinic instead of in their villages with an untrained person. So far, we've completed or are in the midst of a randomized control trial, and preliminary results show that we've doubled the rate at which women deliver their babies safely. So we think that's pretty exciting in terms of behavior change. And right now, we're looking to focus more on scaling up. So we have 5,000 women enrolled, and we're looking to increase that to about 40,000 women next year. To answer your question about why this is important, one of the things we always say internally is there's a really big cost of free. So if you're a rural woman living on a few dollars a day, sending your kids to get immunizations or going to a health clinic has enormous costs, from transportation to the cost of leaving work for several hours to a bunch of different, overcoming a lot of traditional beliefs. So essentially there's behaviors that have a long-term benefit but a short-term cost. And so by removing those costs, we can increase adoption of these healthy behaviors.
Thank you. Very interesting. Actually, Sveta, let me start. Let us carry on with you, in fact. Why did you decide that cash transfers was the right approach for you to take, for your organization to take?
Yeah. I was doing research at the Center for Effective Global Action, and what really was amazing was there's a huge body of evidence about cash transfers. And what's great about that is we know equally about what works as what does not. And so when really looking at a lot of development, we see today that huge amounts of funding go into the supply side, you know, building clinics, building schools. But what good are these resources if they're unused? And so huge cash transfer programs in Brazil and Mexico have showed that really small targeted incentives can really change the behaviors and future lives of families.
Very interesting. And Tim, I guess you're in the business of creating incentives and changing behavior of people in this room, for example, but the work that GiveWell does is all about trying to get more people involved in giving and finding the right organizations for them to give to. Why is it important to get people, the individuals involved, as opposed to, say, you know, massive agencies and national governments?
Sure. I mean, I actually think that they're both important. I actually don't necessarily want to claim that that a strategy of going big wouldn't be even more cost effective per dollar or per unit of time that someone might spend on it, depending on how effectively they were able to do that. I do think that the I think one of the opportunities we have looking at the smaller scale direct aid, direct giving, is because it's possible to have a stronger evidence base. It allows, I guess, two things. One is it allows individual donors that might not otherwise have the confidence to give at all to get involved in the project. You know, I think that Peter Singer has been a major proponent of inspiring people to take more action precisely through a sort of more direct understanding of the potential impact that they have as an individual, that they have an individual choice with over people's, possibly over their lives, just with a few thousand dollars. And so I think that you know, building that confidence in that small scale really helps leverage that opportunity. I think it's also possible, though this is pure speculation, but it's possible that that kind of work on that small scale can help inform the larger scale, top-down, more macro approaches that, you know, frankly, I think we also need, and I have no good way of evaluating on a per-dollar basis at this point.
And can it? Can it? Can it inform top-down approaches?
So this question that was posed actually in some of the discussion prior to the panel around, you know, is there a, how do we manage the trade-off between sort of focusing on very evidence-based but specific interventions, but also the kind of more of a systems focus and some of these macro issues? I think those two things don't always have to be at odds. We, I think, have found that by supporting certain specific interventions, either scaling those that already have an evidence base or actually trying to generate the evidence, support an organization to generate the evidence around them, you can also think about how that's influencing a system. So, you know, the first way where I think these two things aren't at odds is interventions that are about improving government service delivery and accountability. So there are, you know, interventions such as one we're working with J-PAL on in India that is around immunization incentives, working with a state government in India to evaluate if incentives sort of address this demand problem in accessing immunizations. That is a potentially kind of system-changing but specific intervention. If the results prove promising, that's something that, because the government's been so involved in the evaluation from the start, could potentially influence that state government's policy as well as national policy, given that this problem exists in many other states. Likewise, we've seen that in a number of other evaluations. So I don't think these two things necessarily have to be at odds, but you know, I agree with what Tim mentioned. Part of the reason why we end up sort of erring on the side of these more specific interventions is when you start trying to think about the evidence around sort of a potentially system-changing intervention, things are really murky and nonlinear, and that doesn't mean there's not potentially huge impact, but it can be very hard to sort of understand the theory of change and be rigorous about it. And we as a funder have chosen to play in one space, but actually, you know, are glad that there are some funders that are sort of more willing to take some of the risks associated with supporting, for example, an activist group or an investigative journalism group in a particular country. But those are things that just, you know, based on what we've chosen to prioritize as our decision criteria in reviewing interventions, don't feel like we can sort of suss out the evidence around enough.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, let's bring you this in here as well. When you're looking, I mean, you've seen this from the perspective of working at a multilateral development bank, the World Bank. You've seen it as the perspective of working at a large NGO as well. What evidence do you look for when you're trying to make decisions about whether to scale something up?
So I see evidence as a spectrum, right? And this is true in the medical space. If you've got some rare disease and you've got some experimental drug, should you take it, should you not? The more trials you've seen, the more promising, the more confidence you're going to have in this. But at the same time, like Michael Kramer's talk earlier, at some point you're going to have to act, make a decision, it's real world, whatever else. A very large challenge for the ecosystem, for a lot of the money put out by big foundations and big governments, is actually we don't have a ton of confidence and maybe even disincentives to really measure it well. And so part of what I think many of the people here are looking to do is to move down that scale a little bit, get a little bit further to the right on this evidence curve, to give themselves more confidence to narrow the error bands. What I think is part of the unique value add, not unique, but part of our value proposition at Evidence Action is to say, all right, there's a lot of really interesting things out there that have a lot of promise, but some of them are going to be way too costly to scale, you know, 702 million people in poverty. If you have to give them each a $100 widget in order to help lift them out of poverty, that's a lot of cash. And so trying to find ways that not only wrap around confidence that they're actually working with pieces of how is this thing going to scale, are there ways that you can recover costs cleverly, such as we're using carbon credits to recover a bunch of our costs on our clean water technique, and all these kind of add up. So it's more of a complex decision-making process than any, you know, there's no silver bullet here, there's no key, right? Anybody's selling you a key to international development and poverty reduction, you don't need to listen to them, right? So,
what do you mean there's a disincentive to measure well?
So one of my favorite papers is by your colleague, Lamp Pritchett, an old one called It Pays to Be Ignorant. And in it, he sets up a theoretical model that talks about how NGOs are often able, for 30 years, governments too, to fundraise successfully. They're already existing. They're fundraising, whatever else. And what's interesting about this model that he sets up is there's not really an incentive for them to set aside their own money to hold themselves really accountable and do a social audit of what they're doing. And if there's not an... Because, in fact, what is that? What are the possible outcomes? In one case, you can show that you're really effective and all of your propaganda that has already allowed you to fundraise is going to lead to the same fundraising you've already done. But there's also a chance that you could prove yourself ineffective and a lot of your propaganda will seem disingenuous and your fundraising could dry up. So the asymmetry in gathering information in this model is that there's only downside risk for collecting this type of information. And I would also argue in my experience that this is very different than the private sector in a lot of ways, where there's a clear link between accountability and learning. And so because everybody up and down this ecosystem is speaking in huge generalizations here, there's a bit of a fear of accountability, and that makes it really hard to be self-reflective and learn. And that's kind of different than Silicon Valley's lean startup, A/B testing, iterative approach to improving over time.
It is part of the problem, because ultimately in development, if you solve the problem, you remove your reason to exist as an organization.
No comment. but I will say that like part of what evidence action has become, in some ways we're doing it perhaps despite our incentives, we are in some ways a holding company for a bunch of new interventions that have promise and that we're trying to scale. And what does that mean? That also means that our value proposition, our board, our advisors, if it turns out that things aren't really working, if we gather more evidence over time or someone else does that something's not promising, we're going to walk away from it knowing that we didn't oversell it at the time. We said, this is a really a smart bet for our money, but if we gather more evidence, we're going to walk away from it if it doesn't work. Or we will say, yeah, but we need to study it in this way in order to get a more full picture. But in the end, evidence is what, if it's not working, we're not going to be scaling it as part of a legacy history forever. We're going to move on. And that could be hard for certain other charities that are set up in different ways, and hard for certain government programs or other things as well.
I didn't mean your organization, yeah. Your admirable organization, by the way. While you were talking, though, there were two other panelists who were nodding, unrecognizing what you were talking about, Sveta and Anne. So I'm wondering if I can get either of you to comment on this issue of, you know, we all talk about the need for more and better data and to evaluate, but are there circumstances when people seek not to, and how do we overcome that?
Yeah, I was nodding because I used to work for different evaluation firms, and so what we saw a lot of times were people, you're selling something, and what you're selling is data. And so the question becomes, well, how do I cook and cut this data to be effective? And so I think what you said is very right, is part of what's happening in this ecosystem is donors and nonprofits are being aligned. And so donors have to ask the hard questions and request a certain standard, right? Because that's what's going to suddenly get nonprofits to be more honest, to have that rigor, and to assess themselves in a really pure empirical way.
So I'll just share a little bit about how we evaluate applications on the potential to scale criterion, because I think it's illustrative of this point. Virtually all of our applicants submit applications at a dollar value and a degree of scale expansion that is entirely unrealistic once you actually start to kick the tires with the applicant on their proposal. And, you know, the incentive for them is very much to sort of go in guns blazing and to suggest that they're ready to scale in 2 years to 5 to 7 countries and to absorb $6 million. But because that may have been their experience with many other donors. Fortunately, we have sort of a process whereby we can have a lot of discussion with an applicant once it sort of moves past a certain stage in our process to really kick the tires on that. And it's really about probing on the extent to which they have, you know, good partnerships with the government as, you know, a potentially sort of longer term implementation partner. But I think the incentives there are, it's hard to be honest about what you think, what you're actually capable of. And we definitely value, I think, highly among applicants or applicants that are very competitive with us, our organizations that are very transparent, very data oriented, and have a clear sort of culture of organizational learning based on that data collection. So, you know, evidence action, full transparency, was until, you know, the last couple of months when their grant with us ended. I was just at the end of the regular time period. Evidence action is a great example of that type of organizational culture, very data-driven, very transparent. And that, for us, sort of only reinforces, even if it's sort of transparency around a bump in the road, reinforces sort of our desire to work with an organization like that.
Interesting. Tim, let's just talk to you. Just, you know, for people in the room who are wondering about, you know, how do I do the best good, many will have, you know, bright ideas that they'll want to kind of, you know, do something on the ground, create their own organizations, and they obviously all think, well, I want to scale up. But with the organizations that you study and that you guys review and recommend at GiveWell, are there pitfalls to scaling up sometimes? Are there instances when perhaps you shouldn't scale up?
Sure. I mean, I think the short answer is yes. There's certainly pitfalls. I don't even know that I don't think I have particular ability to predict, you know, when an organization will be ready to scale up or not. But what a lot of times what we've looked for is seeing whether an organization has the opportunity to do more of the work it's shown that it has a track record to complete successfully without dramatically changing its model. And it's not that a model shouldn't be changed, but the way that our model of finding high charities that we can be highly confident in is to look for the ones that, you know, we can predict most consistently will continue to be able to perform and including at scale. So we've had times where, for example, with the Against Malaria Foundation, a couple of years ago, we had given them enough funding that they had struggled to get some of the funding out the door because they couldn't even sign up enough bed net distributions to be able to use all that money. And so we actually recommended for a year that donors give to other charities instead while they tried to use that funding. I actually think that that's, in my mind, I think that's the type of thing you should expect to happen if you're properly paying attention to your cost effectiveness per dollar and not just prioritizing scale above all else. You know, I'm very glad that AMF didn't instead just, you know, throw all the money out the door as its first priority. So those are my thoughts on that.
So just from the perspective of my organization, CGD, I mean, I said that we focus on policy. You've all talked in some degree about interventions, about investing in specific interventions. And also, you've talked about building capacity within countries to deliver services better themselves. But from the perspective of our organization, you know, if you want to really help developing countries, you can do that by changing our own country's policies towards them, or the policies of powerful institutions like the World Bank, where you used to work, Jeff. So I'm going to kind of just add that into the mix, and I'd like to get a few thoughts from you all about trade-offs and priorities between focusing on interventions or how to make country governments in the developing world better themselves versus the effect you could have by changing, say, the US policy on trade or the US policy on migration or, you know, the British policy, let's not pick on the US. So let's get some thoughts on that before we open it up to questions from the audience, and then you're off the hook a little bit more. Who'd like to start?
I'll start, being of the U.S. government. So, I mean, I'll kind of go back to my earlier point around, you know, I think these two things, sort of supporting specific evidence-based interventions and sort of broader policy and systems change, even of our kind of own system, are not necessarily mutually exclusive. The program I run, DIV, you know, its intended sort of vectors of impact are twofold. One is the impact that we can have by the kind of hopefully smart decisions we make about the things we fund. So the impact on, you know, the poor in developing countries via the interventions we support. But the second vector is really about the demonstration effect of this type of model in how we as the U.S. government deploy foreign assistance. We are but a very small part of USAID's approximately $20 billion annual budget. But a large part of what we aspire to do is actually share the lessons and experience that we've gleaned over the past 6 years since our founding with others in the agency that want to do more evidence-based funding. To other bilaterals, we have phone calls upon phone calls with other bilaterals who are interested in doing more of this and have over the course of many years, as well as developing country governments themselves who want to actually sort of fund in this type of way. So I think there's definitely a way that through a program that supports specific interventions, actually trying to use that as the kind of, you know, demonstration case for a different way of making funding decisions. But, you know, to your question, it's hard to actually do. It's hard to find the time for. We're a small team. And it's hard to have a lot of influence. The agency is a large agency. The bilateral community, there are many of them. There are many other funders beyond the bilaterals, and there are certainly many developing country governments. So We aspire to do that and have had some impact in that regard, but certainly there's always more we can do to share our experience.
And I have one question for you. Is there something that Effective Altruism community could do to help DIV have more of an influence on the rest of USAID?
That is a great question. We can talk offline. Yeah. But by the way, just a plug for GiveWell, I mean, our team definitely leverages, not exclusively and not necessarily determinatively, the wealth of information that GiveWell does provide very, you know, transparently on the conversations they've had, the analyses they've done. So it's definitely sort of been a factor in some of our due diligence on organizations. So we appreciate that.
Great.
And USAID, the single biggest donor in terms of aid in the world, very generous, makes a lot of effort. But Jeff, ending poverty is not going to be done through aid, is it? Aid is very important, especially for the poorest and the most vulnerable countries. But for others, it's not going to be done through aid, is it? There are other ways.
Yeah, I mean, this gets to like very old, out of date literature that I looked at in grad school, and so you should dig deeper. But I think that because we are mostly coming from the ground up right here in this panel, this in fact is a bit of a biased conversation compared to this big question. And as others have hinted at in earlier parts of the conversation, growth is going to matter a ton here, right? And economic growth is a huge driver to reducing poverty. It's what's pushed a lot of the progress. A lot of the places that have done really well, like China, haven't been touched by a ton of international NGOs or foreign aid, and it's growth that's helping lift them out. And, you know, there's other things that I think are worth taking a look at, one of which is migration, citing another bunch of research by Lamp Pritchett and others. If we relaxed all of our trade barriers, we're looking at like 3% of GDP growth a year increase, which is nothing to sneeze at when it compounds over years. But some thought exercises suggest that you could double world GDP by allowing people to move wherever they wanted. Lots of trade-offs there. You know, it's not easily done, but there are some things that are often not there. Sorry. Governments have huge impact on a lot of these types of things, both rich country and poor country governments. And you know, the type of work that Anne is doing and all the frustrations that she might face on a day-to-day basis working within a government, like without her and plenty of other people trying to push this big type of organization, like the world would be a worse off place. And so I wouldn't suggest, my hope is that over the next 20 years, all of you are pushing these things in lots of different directions, because if we put all our eggs in one basket, it's not going to be enough to do that.
Yeah, good point. Good point, I think, to open it up to questions from the audience as well. So we have, I think, yeah, we have 10 minutes, I think. Oh, audience questions, here they are. Great, okay. Very clever. Okay, so this first question. One of the things that shocked me about this talk was the assertion that we can end global poverty in 10 years. What do the panelists believe is the probability that we can do so? And I think the SDGs is a 15-year framework, but the question is still valid. I guess that's a big question, really, isn't it? Can we achieve the end of poverty? That's only the first question as well. It gets harder after that. Let's start on the ground. Your results, you were telling us, with pregnant women in Nigeria, doubled the rate of safe delivery. How optimistic does that make you feel for development and the ability to generate progress over the next 10, 15 years?
I mean, makes me a little optimistic, but I mean, the goal doesn't matter when we end poverty, it's just relative, right? It matters if we're taking small, consistent steps as fast as we can. So I guess I don't really know the answer to your question.
Anyone else have thoughts on that? Can we achieve an end to poverty?
Fine. look, so I... This is just sweeping generalizations, but if you look at U.S. history, 200 years, there's been a lot of growth driving these things, and we have major pockets that are challenging too. I expect that to happen at a grand scale over the next 20 years. It's already been happening a long time, but at a grand scale in the U.S. as well. I think that the It's kind of an artificial question, though, because poverty is an artificial construct of where you draw the line. Mm-hmm. And guess what? There are a whole bunch of people who suggest that that extreme poverty line or even the just other poverty line aren't really fair, ethical, sufficient, whatever else. And so I predict that we're going to redraw the line 30 years from now, and that's great, and that's a march of progress.
Yep. Okay, here's a question for you, Anne. What is your dream high-risk intervention that you'd like an organization to apply for DIV funds to make an impact where need is highest?
It's a good question. I'll deflect.
Maybe this guy has an idea for one.
I'll deflect. So, I mean, our whole point is that we can't, you know, just kind of dream up all of the good, you know, testable ideas that there might be. I think there are lots of, you know, I'd put the question back to the question asker and say, you think about the problem you're trying to solve rather than the solution or idea you might have. There's a lot of starting with the solution in development and trying to find problems that it might solve. I think that is particularly true among sort of developed world technology, and that's not necessarily the right way to be approaching things. So if you have a good idea or you think it's a good idea, definitely apply. But you know, we'll sort of kick the tires on it just like we would anything else.
I'm glad to hear that. This one's for all of you, really. To what extent is there a risk that emphasis on quantitative measurement might narrow the scope of, quoting here, collaborative, multi-pronged projects or projects that might take a long time to see payoff? Is there a place for qualitative data / evidence, and if so, what is it? This is something that really affects kind of policy work, really, because it's very hard to kind of show a direct line between the research that, say, CGD does and a policy impact. It's one that you can make approximations of, but in the work that you guys do, is there a role for qualitative data, and does the emphasis on quantitative data push out other useful means of gauging impact? Tim, have a go?
Sure. Absolutely. There's definitely a place for qualitative data. I think that, you know, in a lot of the decisions we make in trying to compare different charities on our top charities list, the cost-effectiveness analysis, which is really the heart of the quantitative side, is really only one part of a larger puzzle. Because we would love it if we could create a cost-effectiveness analysis that perfectly captured all of the data and all the information that we wanted to, and added it into one number, and you could just like press enter, and you could see which charity ended up on top. But unfortunately, we don't believe that we can create that. In fact, we don't even think we're going to have that anytime soon. And so instead, what we do is we do rely on a lot of qualitative factors, like our judgment of how how high quality an organization is, or the level of transparency, whether we think that whether we think that the organization has opportunities to scale, which isn't something that you can very easily put into numbers. So I actually think that the qualitative side has to be big, and I think that, in fact, I do think that's something that sometimes is lost a little bit in the effective altruism community, is expecting that we can, or trying too hard to have everything be quantitative, because I think that can be an unrealistic standard.
That's interesting, actually.
I'd echo all of that, but I'd also say, you know, again, I think, you know, from a funder's perspective, you know, every funder has to make a choice about sort of what they use as their core set of decision criteria. Ours happen to, you know, focus on evidence and cost effectiveness and potential to scale, and we think that's a good thing. But, you know, I'll give you an example of something that came into our application pool that we rejected, but that, you know, I still would love to be supported, and that's a very well-regarded, perhaps the most well-regarded international organization focused on investigative journalism. And they proposed to us starting and training a network of investigative journalists in the Middle East. They have an extraordinarily good track record. Their very small budget and very small cadre of very good reporters have contributed to, I won't say caused, contributed to the seizure of billions of dollars of assets, the high-profile resignations of government officials in multiple countries. That's an organization that I, as someone who cares about government accountability, I want someone funding that. But the theory of change that was articulated is again, it's murky stuff. That's not to say it's bad or not real in some way, but it's not tight enough in the way that we as a funder have chosen to focus to be able to justify funding it. But I want someone else funding it.
Okay. Final thoughts, guys. For people in the room who are interested in thinking more about the end of poverty, how to end poverty, or what are the challenges in that proposition, what would you direct them to think about? Or what would you direct them to? If there's one thing that you'd think, you'd say, okay, go away and think about this, go away and think about X, what would you suggest that might be? Why don't I help you out here? I'll start. I would say, and it's nice to see that the Effective Altruism Conference this year is taking more of an interest in this, I would say think about policy. Policy is how you can affect the lives of millions of people at the stroke of a pen. It's hugely important. Policy research. We heard from Seb Farquhar before about the difference between policy and politics, and you might get put off politics, but you shouldn't be put off policy. So that's what I would say, my two cents. So I bought you a bit of time there, a bit of thinking time. Now it's your turn. Who'd like to go first? Jeff.
I have nothing. I think it's going to be hard for you all when I'm thinking about the careers that you might continue to pursue, changes you might make, ways you might allocate your own time, ways you might allocate your own resources. I think we haven't figured this stuff out, and therefore you're going to have to go your own ways a little bit, and I hope you do it in a careful, analytical way as much as you can, but you shouldn't be taking advice from someone like me as to what to do, because I don't want to choke off any innovation, anything else, because you guys are going to be the real people who help us solve this stuff, plus a whole bunch of other people who aren't in this room right now, don't look to others. I think that's my bottom line.
But that's a great point. You're basically saying what you said before, which is about pushing in all different directions. Yeah, good point. Who wants to go next? You're not leaving the stage till you've all gone, so you might as well suck it up.
Well, I guess mine is sort of similar to that one, so I'll go next. I think that if you see something that you think is a weak link or something that might be missing, then I think it's good to push on that, even if pushing on that means just talking to more people or people that are more expert or thought about it more, you would expect to have thought about it more, until you either get a more dissatisfying answer, or if you convince yourself that this is a legitimate weak link or something that someone should be doing but no one is, then consider whether you're the right person to do it or to find the right person to do it. And I think that is a sort of very risky strategy. There'll be a lot more failures than successes, but if you're interested in that, and then that might be a good way to try. And if not, you can always just donate your money to good causes.
Anna Sweta, who wants to go next?
I'd say start looking at the data, like global disease priority data, look at what are the causes of mortality and see, well, what of those are tractable, and then to go out and validate that, because we don't need more duplication. And even when starting new incentives, I pitched the idea to 100 NGOs and said, I'll volunteer my time to do this. So I think it's always important to, like, there's probably good reasons people aren't pursuing those interventions, so to figure them out and then see if, like you said, there's really a gap that needs to be filled.
And I'll put a plug in for things sort of around the evidence, and that's the hard slog of scaling evidence-based interventions. That can involve a lot of policy work, both of developed countries, but also in particular developing countries, where, 10, 15 years ago, there was much less sort of rigorous evidence in international development. There is now a lot more, thanks to a lot of really capable organizations. But the kind of science and art, part science, part art of scaling those has not been perfected. And a lot of the work of scaling is hard and not linear and a slog, and maybe for some people less sexy than the evidence generation part of sort of the evidence into action spectrum. But it's really important work, and ultimately it's the only way the kind of evidence generation really matters is if it's sort of translated to large-scale impact on the ground. So, you know, even if it's less sexy to you, I'd suggest you think about what role you could play in that.
And I would just echo all of those sentiments and just add, don't be downcast. You know, it seems like a really tough task, but look at all the progress the world has made already. And with the brains in this room, on this stage, and out at this conference and in the wider world, I'm sure we can make a great difference in the world. With that, please thank my panel. Thank you very much.